fired, it can be tracked by an observer back to its source, and then return fire can be directed against whoever is firing. But as the range of artillery increased and we found ways to camouflage guns, we became proficient in hiding artillery until the advent of battlefield radar, which allows the trajectory of shells to be tracked back to their source. But imagine if the shell were composed of a material that rendered it invisible to radar. That was the possibility we proposed to General Trudeau, an invisible artillery shell. I suggested to him in his office one morning as we were designing the plan for research and development of composite materials. On the night battlefield of the future, you could deploy weapons that were invisible even to radar tracking planes flying overhead behind the lines. Shells would start falling, and the enemy wouldn't know where they were coming from until after we had the advantage of five or more unanswered salvos. By then, with the advantage of surprise, the damage might well be done. If we were using mechanized artillery, we could set up positions, fire a series of quick salvos, redeploy, and set up again. The secret lay not just in the same stealth aircraft technology, but also in the development of a stealth ceramic that could withstand the tremendous explosive barrel pressures and still maintain an integrity through the arc of its trajectory. The search for just such a molecularly aligned composite ceramic was inspired by the composite material of the Roswell spacecraft. In analysis after analysis, the Army tried to determine how the extraterrestrials fabricated the material that formed the hull of the spacecraft, but was unable to do so. The search for the kind of molecularly aligned composite began in the 1950s, even before General Trudeau took command of the R&D, continued during my tenure at Foreign Technology when the early stealth experimentation began at Lockheed that resulted in the F-117 fighter and stealth bomber, and continues right through to today. The general was also more than interested in the kinds of warheads we would propose for just such a shell, a warhead that did come into use in 1961 and was successfully deployed during the Gulf War. And we had a suggestion for a round that we thought could change the nature of the kinds of battles we projected we'd be fighting against the Warsaw Pact forces, a warhead fabricated out of depleted uranium. This was a way to utilize the stockpile of uranium we foresaw we'd have as a result of spent fuel from commercial nuclear reactors, reactors powering U.S. Navy vessels, and the nuclear reactors the Army was developing for its own bases and for delivery to bases overseas. Depleted uranium was a dense, heavy metal, so dense, in fact, that conventional armament was no match for a high-speed round tipped with it. Its ability to penetrate even the toughest of tank armor and detonate once it was inside the enemy vehicle meant that a single round fired from one of our own tanks equipped with a laser rangefinder would disable, if not completely destroy, an enemy tank. Depleted uranium would give us a decided advantage on a European battlefield on which we knew we'd be outnumbered 2 or 3 to 1 by the Warsaw Pact, or in China, where sheer numbers alone would mean that either we'd be overwhelmed or we'd have to resort to nuclear weapons. The depleted uranium shell kept us from having to go nuclear. Privately, I suggested to General Trudeau that depleted uranium also fulfilled our hidden agenda. It was another weapon in a potential arsenal we were building against hostile extraterrestrials. If depleted uranium could penetrate armor, might the heaviness of the element enable it to penetrate the composite skin of the spacecraft, especially if the spacecraft were on the ground? I suggested that it certainly merited development at the nearby Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, and if it proved worthwhile, it was a weapon we should deploy. Even though the composite ceramic stealth round is still an elusive dream in weapons development, the depleted uranium-tipped warhead saw action in the Gulf War, where it didn't just disable the tanks of the Iraqi Republican Guard, it exploded them into pieces. fired from laser rangefinder-equipped Abrams tanks, TOW missile launchers, or even from Hedgehog infantry support aircraft, the depleted uranium-tipped warheads wreaked havoc in the Gulf. They were one of the great weapons development successes of Army R&D that came out of what we learned from the Roswell crash. HARP, the High Altitude Research Project. HARP was another project whose need for research and development was suggested by the challenge posed by flying saucers. They could outfly our own aircraft. We had no guided missiles that could bring them down, and we didn't have any guns that could shoot them down. We were also exploring weapon systems that had a double or triple use, and HARP, or the Big Gun, was one such system. Essentially, Project HARP was the brainchild of Canadian gunnery expert and scientist Dr. Gerald Bull. Bull had studied the threat posed by the German Big Bertha in World War I and the Nazi V-3 supergun toward the end of World War II. He realized that long-range, high-powered artillery was not only a practical solution to launching heavy payload shells, it was also very affordable once the initial research and development phase was completed. Mass-produced big guns and their ordnance, assembled in stages right on the site, could provide enormous firepower well back from the front lines to any army. They would become a strategic weapon to rain nuclear destruction down on enemy population centers or military staging areas. Dr. Bull had also suggested that the gun could be retasked as a launch vehicle, blasting huge rounds into orbit, which could then be jettisoned like the booster stage of rockets, so the payload warhead could thrust itself into position. This would require a minimum amount of rocket fuel and could effectively push a string of satellites into orbit very quickly, almost like an artillery barrage. If the Army needed to put special satellites into orbit in a hurry, or better still, explosive satellites that would pose a threat to orbiting extraterrestrial vehicles, the Big Gun was one method of accomplishing this mission. There was still a third potential to the supergun. General Trudeau foresaw the ability of this weapon to launch rounds that could ultimately be placed into lunar orbit, especially if hostilities broke out between the United States and USSR, or, as we expected, between Earth military forces and the extraterrestrials. We could supply a military moon base without having to rely on rocket launch facilities, which would demand long turnaround times and be very vulnerable to attack. A camouflaged supergun, even a series of superguns, would allow us all the benefits of a field artillery or quick-response anti-aircraft unit, but with a piece that could launch payloads into space. It was this combination of capabilities that delighted General Trudeau because it enabled one R&D project to help create many different systems. The United States, Canada, and the British military combined their joint expertise to find ways to develop Dr. Bull's supergun with General Trudeau, I believe, becoming one of Bull's staunchest supporters. But by the time military budget decisions had to be made to fund the weapon, all of the government's military establishments had become committed to the guided missile and rocket-launched space vehicle rather than a supergun. While the weapon had some potential, the United States, UK, and Canada were too far along with their own missile programs to start up a completely new type of weapon. And in the end, they decided to end the research while still keeping close tabs on Bull's efforts to sell his technology to other powers, especially governments in the Middle East. Through the 1980s, Gerald Bull, whom I had met at a reception honoring General Trudeau in 1986, entered into negotiations with the Israelis as well as with the Iraqis and perhaps even the Iranians. The decade-long war between Saddam Hussein and Iran proved a fertile sales territory for weapons merchants in general, and particularly for Gerald Bull, who was courted by both sides. In the end, he cut his deal with the Iranians, testing experimental versions of the supergun and planning to build the monster weapons before the British intervened and seized shipments of gun barrel units before they were shipped out of the country. By this time, Dr. Bull may have become a liability to the Iraqis, as well as to the Israelis and to the United States as well, and was shot to death outside his apartment in Belgium before the outbreak of the Gulf War. Like Jules Verne's character Barbicane in From Earth to the Moon, Bull had a vision of the potential of a long-range artillery piece. Unlike Barbicane, he came very close to proving it a practical way of launching vehicles into space. The murder of Gerald Bull has never been solved, and whatever secrets he still possessed about the assembly of a gun to launch vehicles into space probably died with him in the hallway outside his apartment. List of omissions. As I worked through the stack of projects on my desk during the spring months of 1962, I found I was devoting more of my time to the Roswell file and less to some of the other projects under development. It was apparent to me that the treasure trove we'd retrieved from Roswell was beginning to pay off in ways that not even I had thought would happen. There were so many Army research projects underway, I told my boss, that were not foundering but sputtering along that could benefit from something similar found in the Roswell wreckage if we could find the match between the two. Night vision, lasers, and fiber optic communication were obvious, I said to him, but I was sure there were other areas we could find just by looking at the problems posed by what we discovered from Roswell, not just retrieved from the wreckage.
Make it specific, Phil, the general asked. What do you mean?
If you just look at what we didn't find at the crash site, I said, that goes a long way to explaining the differences between what we are and what they are. It also shows us what we need to develop if we're going to prepare for long periods of travel in space.
Can you make me a list? The general asked. There are a lot of ongoing research contracts out there that could benefit from a list of things we'd have to concern ourselves with if we're going to be planning for space travel in the next 50 years.
By the time our conversation was finished, General Trudeau had asked me to prepare not only a list of what were called the omissions at Roswell, but a very brief report detailing the areas where I thought development needed to take place. So I assembled all the reports and information in the Roswell file and began looking for what was missing that I might expect to find at a space traveler's crash site. There was no mention in any of the reports of any food source or nutrient, and no one discovered any food preparation units or stored food on board the spacecraft, nor were there any refrigeration units for food preservation. There was no water on the ship for drinking, washing, or flushing of waste, nor were there any waste or garbage disposal facilities. The Roswell field report said that the retrieval team found something they thought was a first aid kit because it contained material that a doctor said was for bandaging purposes. But there were no medical facilities, nor any medications. And finally, the Army retrieval team said there were no rest facilities at all on board the ship, nothing that could be construed as a bunk or a bed. From this available data, the Army assumed that this UFO was a reconnaissance craft and could quickly return to a larger or mothership where all the missing items might be found. The other explanation Dr. Herman Oberth came up with was that this was a time-dimensional travel ship that didn't traverse large distances in space. Rather, it jumped from one time space to another, or from one dimension to another, and instantly returned to its point of origin. But this was just Dr. Oberth's speculation, and he would usually discount any of it the moment he believed I was taking it as fact. I believed, however, that the EBEs didn't require food or facilities for waste disposal because they were fabricated beings just like robots or androids who had been created specifically for space travel and the performance of specific tasks on the planets they visited. Just like our lunar rover in the 1970s, which was a robot, so these creatures had been programmed with specific tasks to perform and carried them out. Perhaps their program could be updated or altered from a remote source, but they weren't life forms that required ongoing sustenance. They were the perfect creatures for long voyages through space and for visiting other planets. Human beings, however, weren't robots and did require sustenance. Therefore, it would be necessary to provide for long-term sustenance and waste disposal needs if humans were going to travel long distances in space. Other scientists from our R&D ad hoc brain trust suggested that indeed this could have only been a scout ship that either got caught in our tracking radars from the 509th or from Alamogordo, or was hit by lightning in the fierce electrical storm that night. They believed that the ship was navigated by an electromagnetic propulsion system. Other scientists suggested that even before we could generate the necessary power to drive such a propulsion system, we would have to have developed some sort of nuclear-powered ion drive first. As for the absence of food, scientists suggested that this would pose a major drawback for long-term human space exploration. Thus, in my quick and dirty proposal for General Trudeau, I suggested that the Army have to complete the development of at least two items that I knew had been in the R&D system for at least 10 years, a food supply that could never spoil and didn't require refrigeration, and an atomic drive that could be assembled in space out of components as the power plant for an interplanetary spacecraft. Irradiated foods. The general read my notes a few days later and seemed impressed. He knew from the memo I had left him the night before that I'd be ready to talk about my omissions list the next day, but he didn't say anything to me right away. Instead, he picked up the phone, dialed a number, told someone at the other end he'd be right over, then looked up at me. "Go get your hat," he said. "Meet me on the helipad. We've been invited to lunch." 10 minutes later, after the general's helicopter had picked us up, we circled the Pentagon once and were flown over to the Quartermaster Center. An officer, who shall remain anonymous, met us at the helipad. He saluted as we got off the chopper. "Thank you for joining us." He took us inside to a downstairs storeroom where he showed off shelves and shelves of all types of meat, fruit, and vegetables. "Look at this pork," he said. "It's been stored here unrefrigerated for months, and it's completely free of trichinoworm." He held up a couple of loose eggs and a chicken breast. "Eggs. Unrefrigerated, and chicken, completely free of bacterium salmonella. And that's the same for the seafood." He escorted us along the shelves of food and, almost like a salesman, presented the virtues of each of the items. The food was wrapped, but not vacuum sealed, in a clear cellophane to keep it free from dust and surface dirt, but it was not preserved in any manner that I could determine. "Free of fungus or any spores," he said about the vegetables. "No mold or any insect infestations in the fruit," he said. "And the milk? It's been here on the shelf for over 2 years, and it's not even slightly sour. We've taken great steps to preserve food completely without any salting, smoking, refrigeration, freezing, or even canning."
"Does this answer one of your questions, Colonel?" General Trudeau asked as we looked at the stocks of food that seemed completely resistant to spoilage.
The commanding general of the Quartermaster Center joined us in the stockroom. "Pick your lunch, gentlemen," he said, and chose a thick steak for himself. "I'm going to have this, and if you don't mind, I'll take the liberty of ordering up the same for you, General Trudeau, and you too, Colonel. How about some potatoes and maybe some strawberries for dessert? All fresh, delicious, and harmless. Then he paused, and completely bombarded with what some people would call lethal doses of radiation to destroy any bacteria or infestation. We were escorted upstairs to the commandant's dining room, where we were joined by a number of other officers and civilian research and food technology experts who described the process of ionizing radiation to destroy the harmful bacteria while preserving the food without canning or smoking. The irradiation process was so complete that if the food were maintained in an antiseptic or dust-free atmosphere, it wouldn't be attacked and would remain uncontaminated. However, because the atmosphere was as dirty as any other atmosphere inside any other building, the food was wrapped in cellophane. Other foods were packaged in a clear plastic wrap and were displayed for visitors just like us, as if they were on supermarket shelves. We first wanted to determine whether the whole concept of irradiated food was safe, one of the engineers explained. So, our first studies were made with food which was irradiated and then stored in the frozen area. We fed these foods to rats and noticed no harmful effects. Then we did the same thing, except this time we increased the radiation to 6 megarads, then froze the food. Again, no harmful effects. His presentation continued while we ate, accompanied by charts that showed how the sterilization rate was increased to try to find any harmful effects on rats. Then they tested the irradiated and frozen food on human volunteers. But wait, I asked. I still don't understand why you irradiated the food and then froze it. The engineer was waiting for this question because he had his answer already prepared. He acted like he'd been asked it many times before. Because, he said, we were testing only the harmful effects for radiation, not for spoilage, not for taste, not even for harmful effects from the food itself, even though we knew it had been sterilized and was tested completely free from bacteria when it was defrosted. What we needed to prove in field trials was the harmlessness to animals and humans of the irradiation process. Then he described the field trials to prove that irradiation preserved food stored at room temperature. We selected high spoilage foods, he said, like the meats, chicken, and especially the seafood. We also made composite foods like stews, which we fed to rats and dogs, along with straight meat and then straight tuna. We first irradiated a sample at 3 megarads, and then another sample at 6 megarads, and tested the animals over a period of 6 months to see whether radiation became concentrated in any of their organs or bones. He paused, letting the traumatic effect of what he was going to say sink in while we were sinking our teeth into the irradiated foods that resulted from the years of experimentation throughout the 1950s. No toxicological effects whatsoever. And we were very thorough before we tested these foods on human volunteers. What's next? I asked. We're setting taste trials of favorite foods at Fort Lee, Virginia, to see how troops in the field respond to this. We think that before the end of the decade, we'll have a variety of meals ready to eat for troops in the field who have no benefit of cooking facilities or refrigeration. General Trudeau looked across the table at me and I nodded. This was perfectly good food that was right up to any quality you'd care to measure. Gentlemen, General Trudeau said as he stood, as a 3-star general, he was the highest-ranking officer in the room, and when he spoke, everyone was silent. My assistant believes your work is of utmost importance to the U.S. Army, our nation, and the world, and will contribute to our travels in space. I am of the very same opinion. We are most impressed with your test results and want to help you expand your operation and speed up the testing process. The Army needs what you've developed. In the next 2 weeks, submit to me your supplementary budget to expand your operation, and I want it also included into next year's budget. Then he turned to me, nodded, and we thanked the commanding general for lunch and walked out to General Trudeau's helicopter.
"How about that, Phil?" he asked. "I think we checked off some of the items on your list right on the spot."
The pilot helped the general into his seat, and I got around on the other side.
"So what do you think?" he asked again.
"I think if we move any faster, we'll have the EBEs down here asking for some of our irradiated food," I said. General Trudeau laughed as we whisked off the helipad and headed back for the short jump to the Pentagon.
"Now you gotta get to work finding out what you can about your atomic propulsion system. If NASA ever gets into its mind to push ahead with building its space station, I'd like the military to have a power source that can keep us up there for a while. If we can get a surveillance window on our visitors, I want it sooner rather than later."
And before the week was out, I was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, again looking at the developments the Army had made in the development of portable nuclear reactors. Portable atomics. A challenge posed to us directly by the Army's retrieval of the Roswell craft and our further discovery that the craft was not propelled by a conventional engine, either propeller, jet, or rocket, pressed upon us the critical realization that if we were to engage these extraterrestrial creatures in space, we would need a propulsion system that gave us a capability for long-distance travel similar to theirs. But we had no such system. The closest form of energy we had that did not rely on a constant supply of fuel was atomic power in a controlled, sustained reaction. And even that was far away from development. However, at the close of the war, the Army had operational control over atomic weapons because under General Leslie Groves, director of the Manhattan Project, the Army had established the bureaucracy that developed and deployed the atomic bomb. So for Army engineers struggling to find out how the Roswell spacecraft was powered, atomic power was the easiest form of propulsion to seize upon, in part because it was the most immediate. However, by 1947, a struggle was already breaking out within the Truman administration over who would control nuclear power, a civilian commission or the military. As the nation was making the transition from wartime to peacetime, the specter of a General Groves secretly dictating how and in what manifestation atomic power would be used frightened Truman's advisors. So in the end, President Truman made the decision to turn control of the nation's nuclear program over to a civilian commission. Thus, by 1947, the Army was getting out of running the nuclear power business, but that didn't mean that research into the military applications of nuclear power plants stopped. We needed to develop nuclear reactors, not only to manufacture nuclear power propulsion systems for naval vessels and for on-site installations of power generating stations, but to experiment with ways nuclear power could be made portable in space by assembling systems in orbit from component parts. This would enable us to maintain long-term outposts in space and even to power interplanetary vessels that could serve as a defensive force against any extraterrestrial hostile forces. If this sounds like science fiction, remember, it was 1947, and the nation had barely gotten out of World War II before the Cold War had begun. War, not peace, was on the minds of the military officers who were in charge of the Roswell retrieval and analysis of the wreckage. The Army, I discovered from the Army Atomic Reactors reports at Fort Belvoir, not only had a very sophisticated portable reactor program underway, but had already built one in cooperation with the Air Force for installation at the Sundance Radar Station, 6 miles out of Sundance, Wyoming, early in 1962. This was a highly sophisticated piece of power-generating apparatus that provided steam heat to the radar station, electrical power for the base, and a very precisely controlled separate power supply for the delicately calibrated radar equipment. But this wasn't the first portable power plant, as most people thought it was. The first portable nuclear reactor plant anywhere was for a research facility in Greenland under the Arctic ice cap, designed for Camp Century, an Army Corps of Engineers project 900 miles from the North Pole. Ostensibly operated by the Army Polar Research and Development Center conducting experiments in the Arctic winter, Camp Century was also a vital observation post in an early warning system monitoring any Soviet activity at or near the North Pole and any activity related to UFO sightings or landings. During the years when I was at the White House, the UFO Working Group had consistently pushed President Eisenhower to establish a string of formal listening posts, electronic pickets staffed by Army and Air Force observers at the most remote parts of the planet to report on any UFO activity. General Twining's group had argued that if the EBEs had any plans to establish semi-permanent Earth bases, it wouldn't be in a populated area or an area where our military forces could monitor. It would be at the poles, in the middle of the most desolate surroundings they could find, or even underneath the ocean. The polar cap seemed like the most obvious choices because during the 1950s we had no surveillance satellites that could spot alien activity from orbit, nor did we have a permanent presence at the two poles. It was thought that we wouldn't be able to put any sophisticated devices at the poles either because doing so would require more power than we could transport. However, the Army's nuclear power program, developed in the 1950s at Fort Belvoir, provided us with the ability to install a nuclear-powered base anywhere on the planet. In 1958, work was started on the Camp Century power plant, which was to be constructed beneath the ice in Greenland. Initially, this was supposed to be top secret, because we didn't want the Soviets to know what we were up to. Ultimately, however, the high security classification proved too unwieldy for the Army because too many outside contractors were involved, and the logistics, transportation to Thule, Greenland, then installation on skids beneath the ice pack created a cover story nightmare. So Army intelligence decided to drop the security classification entirely and treat the entire plant as a scientific information gathering expedition by its polar research group. Just like the whole camouflage operation that had protected the existence of the working group, Camp Century provided the perfect cover for testing out a procedure for constructing a prefabricated, prepackaged nuclear reactor under arduous conditions and flying it to its site for final assembly. It also provided the Army with the means of testing the performance of the reactor and how it could be maintained at an utterly desolate location in the harshest climate on the planet. The plant was the first of its kind. It had a completely modular construction that had separately packaged components for air coolers, heat exchangers, switch gear, and the turbine generator. The power plant also had a mechanism that used the recycled steam to melt the ice cap surface to provide the camp's water supply. The entire construction was completed in only 77 days, and the camp remained in operation from October 1960 to August 1963 when the research mission completed its work. The entire operation was successfully taken apart and placed in storage in 1964, and the site of Camp Century was completely restored to its natural state. I received reports about the camp's operation during the later months of 1962 after General Trudeau had asked me about the feasibility of the Army's portable atomics program as a way to instigate research into a launchable atomics program for generating power in orbit. I was so enthusiastic about the success of our portable atomics and the way they provided the research platform for the subsequent development of mobile atomics that I urged the general to provide as much funding as R&D could to enable the Fort Belvoir Army Nuclear Power Program to construct and test as many mobile and portable power plants as possible. Each power plant gave us a kind of beachhead into remote areas of the world where EBEs might have wanted to establish a presence because they believed they could go about it undetected. They were kind of a platform. Once we had demonstrated the ability to protect remote areas of the Earth, we'd be in a better position to establish a presence in space. The Atomics program, which was in part a direct outgrowth of the challenge posed to us from our analysis of the Roswell craft, ultimately helped us develop portable atomic power plants, which are now used to power Earth satellites as well as naval vessels. It showed us that we could have portable atomic generators and gave the Army a longer reach than anybody might have thought. Ultimately, it allowed us to maintain surveillance and staff remote listening posts. It also provided the basis for research into launching nuclear power facilities into space to become the power plants of any new generations of interplanetary vehicles. The Portable Atomics Program allowed us to experiment with ways we could develop atomic drives for our own space exploration vehicles, which we believed would enable us to establish military bases on the moon as well as on the planets near us in the solar system. And from our success with atomics, we turned our attention to the development of the weapons we would mount on surveillance satellites in orbit, weapons we developed directly from what we found in the flying saucer at Roswell. Chapter 16. Tesla's Death Ray and the Accelerated Particle Beam Weapon. Embedded in the Army Field Reports and Air Materiel Command engineering evaluations analyzing the Roswell craft were descriptions of how the spacecraft might have utilized a form of energy known as directed energy, powerful beams of excited electrons that could be precisely directed at any target. We didn't know very much about directed energy back in 1947, or more precisely put, we didn't know how much we knew, because in reality, we knew a lot. But the information that had been readily available since the 1930s was lying sequestered at a public storage facility under the authority of the federal government over on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the notes of a mysterious inventor, Nikola Tesla, whose experiments and reputed discoveries have become the stuff of bizarre but exciting legend. The laser surgical cutting tool found in the Roswell wreckage was one form of directed energy beam device whose ability to fire rapidly and with precision revealed that the extraterrestrials had a potential in weaponry far superior to ours. However, if the craft had been brought down by lightning, itself a directed energy beam of one of the highest magnitudes, then it revealed their vulnerability to bolts of electrons. That stimulated the thinking of Army scientists and researchers into the analysis of the potential of a directed energy beam weapon. Today, 50 years after the crash of the spacecraft at Roswell, these weapons are far more than the device that the Emperor Ming aimed at Earth in the Flash Gordon serials. They are a reality that can be launched on a guided missile, separated from a booster, aimed by an internal computer guidance system at any incoming device, whether an ICBM warhead or a space vehicle, and fired with devastating effect. This weapon has been a true Army R&D success story. The possibilities for benefits to the military are enormous, I wrote to General Trudeau in my 1962 analysis of the potential for directed energy weapons, although, as we have seen, even the most rudimentary of directed energy products, the microwave oven, has more than repaid the initial research and development overhead through consumer product sales. It is the military that will see the greatest benefit from directed energy and is already seeing the potential from it in the applications that are being projected for the laser, which is only 2 years old. The concept of a weapon that relied on a directed energy beam, whatever the nature of that beam was not a completely new concept to the military community, although its origins were totally shrouded in secrecy. The first test of a directed energy weapon, a particle beam accelerator codenamed Seesaw, whose beam was to be aimed at incoming guided missiles, was first conducted in 1958, 2 years before the successful demonstration of the laser by the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Although the test took place the year that I was in Red Canyon, New Mexico, I had known about the project first when I was on the National Security Staff at the White House, and then again after the successful experiments against the simulated target. In theory, the particle beam weapon looked like it would work, assuming the technological development of power generators, electrical storage apparatus, and the computer software to aim and fire the weapon. We already had a rough model for the particle beam weapon in nature, the lightning bolt, a pure, intense beam of electrons firing between opposite poles and destroying or incapacitating anything that was not grounded. Scientists from Benjamin Franklin to Nikola Tesla have tried to chain the force of lightning as a power source. Now, the Advanced Research Projects Agency was experimenting with the theory to apply it to a new and deadly weapon. If they could build the hardware and write the software, the developers at ARPA decided they would be able to generate an intense beam of either electrons or neutral hydrogen atoms, aim it at an incoming target, and fire the particle beam in pulses that would travel near the speed of light and excite the atoms in the target until they literally blew apart. Whatever didn't blow up would be destroyed electronically and rendered useless. Officially, the project would remain secret until funding could be acquired and the technological development of the components moved far enough along to allow us to build working prototypes. The great fear of the developers at ARPA was that the Soviets, realizing what we were trying to construct, would maximize their effort to build one before we did, rendering our newly developed Atlas ICBM obsolete before it even got to the launching pad. The Advanced Research Projects Agency was a highly secretive network of defense scientists, members of the industrial defense contractor R&D community, and university researchers operating either under the formula of a government grant or the tacit acknowledgement of the Defense Department that their research would come under government control at some point. ARPA was founded in 1958 in part, I believe, because up to then Army R&D had been a disorganized department barely able to manage the core research necessary to keep us technologically superior to our enemies. This created a gap in research that the Advanced Research Projects Agency was created to fill. Working on military defense-oriented research many times far in advance of any concrete proposals for the development of a weapon system or a product, ARPA often acted as a forward skirmish line for the development of military weapons or simply facilitated the basic scholarship necessary for the more concrete items to be developed. However, too many times it was in conflict with the military because ARPA had its own separate agenda, especially after General Trudeau had reorganized the entire military R&D apparatus and refocused it so that it ran like a machine. In 1969, during the era of large mainframe computers, under a contract to develop a network of networks linking universities, defense contractors, and the military, the ARPANET was born. And in the 1970s, after the Advanced Research Projects Agency changed its name to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, it instituted a project to create an internetting of all the existing computers on its system, instituting the software protocols that would link networks running on different operating systems. By 1974, the Transmitting Control Protocol Internet Protocol was born, and the ARPANET became the Internet. In the late 1980s, the European Laboratory for Particle Physics launched a hypertext language originally conceived of by Vannevar Bush as a search mechanism on the Internet, and by 1990 married it to a graphics user interface that combined hypertext and graphics. The World Wide Web was born. In 1958, when it was first developing the concepts behind the particle beam weapon, ARPA was only a year old. It was formed in 1957 when I was still in the White House, in response to the Soviet Union's successful launch of Sputnik, because the government realized that the United States needed an independent research organization to marshal the resources of the academic, scientific, and industrial communities. ARPA was formed to fund basic research, and even though it didn't have a military orientation at the outset, it quickly became associated with military projects because that was where the government saw the greatest need for basic research into scientific and technical areas. There was another reason for the formation of ARPA that, at least in theory, had a lot to do with the perceived threats facing the United States and the need for basic research to respond to them. ARPA, because it was a network deep inside the government and ultimately the Department of Defense, could engage in research ostensibly far afield from the immediate needs of the military services whose research and development organizations were part of the command structure. ARPA wasn't. Although it reported to its own higher-ups in the Defense Department and at the White House, it was not part of a command structure and didn't have to confine itself to the agendas of the heads of the various special military corps. ARPA didn't just come into existence out of nowhere. Its ancestor, the National Research Council, had been formed under President Wilson to organize and marshal scientific research for defense purposes and as a rival to the Naval Consulting Board, which was run by Thomas Edison, who had gone on record as saying that the country didn't need a naval consulting board at all. He invited scientists he called a bunch of professors down to his laboratory in New Jersey to walk around the scrap heap to see how real inventions were created. University researchers and corporate heads of research and development were naturally appalled at what Edison thought about government-sponsored research for the war effort and rallied around the NRC. If there were government grants to be handed out for basic defense research, the scientists who worked for corporations who needed help in basic research, no matter what its primary purpose was, were anxious to become associated with this new organization. University researchers argued, through the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, that the National Research Council should be an arsenal of science to protect the United States through the application of its great brain trust in academia and industrial contractors to issues of national defense through technology. President Wilson agreed, and the NRC was born. One of the first tasks given to the National Research Council was the development of a submarine defense. Aircraft had not yet made a decisive appearance on the battlefield at the outset of World War I, but German U-boats were ravaging the Atlantic fleets. The Navy was desperately searching for a way to detect submarines, and although Nikola Tesla had submitted his plans for an energy beam detector that would send low-frequency waves through the water to reflect off hidden objects, the National Research Council thought the idea too esoteric and looked for a more conventional technology. Tesla's low energy wave didn't work well in water anyway, but years later, Tesla's description of his invention was the basis for one of the most important devices to come out of World War II, radar. The National Research Council had established a pattern of government support for basic research when it had an aspect to it that could be developed for military purposes. It was the first time that research scientists from the private sector, corporations, academicians, bureaucrats, and the military were brought together to solve mutual problems. Therefore, the Advanced Research Projects Agency and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, son of ARPA, were natural outgrowths of an ongoing government relationship. The problem with ARPA was that it was political and had its own agenda. It was not uncommon for conflicts to arise between the Office of the Chief of Research and Development, General Trudeau, who was operating within the military command structure, and ARPA over money and the policy issues that arose between them. The staffs at ARPA and the Pentagon crossed swords on a number of occasions, and more than once, ARPA tried to lay the blame for its own shortcomings and mistakes on the military. During the early years of the Vietnam War, for example, ARPA tried to blame General Trudeau for mistakes in the deployment of Agent Orange. But General Trudeau and R&D weren't responsible at all for Agent Orange. It was ARPA's baby from the start. But when the field reports started coming in on the casualties Agent Orange was causing among our own troops, and ARPA said that it would testify before Congress that General Trudeau was responsible, I hit the ceiling. I let the ARPA staff people know that. Protocol be damned. I would storm into the Congressional Committees on Military and Defense Veterans Affairs and raise the roof of that Capitol building until everyone knew that ARPA was trying to duck responsibility for negligence in the deployment of a bad chemical. ARPA backed down, but the bad blood between us remained. When the concept of an ARPA was first discussed at the White House, I saw the potential as well as the problem, but I also knew that a secret agenda driving everything was the policy of the UFO working group. ARPA was an asset to them because they could network through the university community and find out who had any information about UFOs that they weren't disclosing to the military, what technology was being developed that had any relation to the problem of UFOs or EBEs, and who in the academic or scientific community were coming up with theories about the existence or intentions of EBEs. In other words, in addition to being a conduit for research and research grants that fit certain government military profiles, ARPA was another intelligence gathering agency, but dedicated to the academic and scientific communities. If information was out there, ARPA was going to find it and pay for its development. Therefore, when the urgency of coming up with a technological challenge to the Soviet space program arose in 1957, it was no surprise to anyone who understood the requirements of a space defense that it would be an organization like ARPA that would be given the mandate to develop the military response. And given the challenge posed by the Soviet satellite program, a particle beam weapon was the logical direction such a response would take. The United States had to develop a weapon that theoretically could knock out the Soviet satellites or blind them so they couldn't take any surveillance photos. They had to gather resources in the academic research community to see whether a talent pool existed for the development of such a weapon. At the same time, they didn't want to divert military research into exotic weapons while the military was still trying to get its own satellites into orbit. But rather than putting the plan directly into the hands of the military R&D organizations, they followed a course probably initially laid out for them by the protocols of the UFO working group and went outside the formal military to an ad hoc research organization that was not supposed to be involved in direct military research. When I was at the White House, I could see the hand of the CIA behind this, which immediately sent up a red flag for me because I knew that the government was only creating another budget and research grant bureaucracy the CIA would ultimately control. It was also no surprise that the first type of weapon whose mission was directed against space vehicles and vehicles re-entering Earth's atmosphere from space was a directed energy weapon an accelerated particle beam because even though it may sound like something out of a science fiction movie, it had a history that stretched back all the way to the early 20th century. Its original creator was Nikola Tesla, some of whose papers were still in my own files when I took over the foreign technology desk in 1961. Tesla was theorizing about directed energy beams, including particle beam weapons, even before the beginning of the 20th century. His now famous death ray was essentially a version of a particle beam weapon that he believed would bring peace to the entire world because it could destroy entire cities anywhere in the world instantly and render squadrons of airplanes, naval fleets, and even entire armies completely useless. But even before his announcement of his death ray, Tesla was making news and a fortune through his experiments with the wireless transmission of electricity and his directed beam of electrons, which would strip the electrons of specimen material inside a light globe. In the 1890s, Tesla was experimenting with a device that would become the 20th century cyclotron, another device that would become television, and he formulated the ideas for what today are the worldwide television and radio networks. Tesla, his background and his history are important to any history of 20th century science and weapons because his thinking was well advanced beyond that of any scientist of his day, including Thomas Edison. And the political implications of what Tesla discovered mixed in with the furious attempts to manage the government cover-up about UFOs and their technological potential in the days and months after the Roswell crash. Nikola Tesla, the son of a Serbian Orthodox minister, came to the United States from Paris in 1884 to meet and work for the acknowledged genius of his day, Thomas Edison. Although the two men would eventually clash like titans over the advantages of alternating current over direct current, Tesla did manage to get a job at the Edison offices and laboratory on what is now West Broadway, south of West Houston Street in New York City. The two men were also very different in the way they approached their inventions. Edison was a tinkerer who would come up with an idea, experiment, build, and rebuild, and experiment again until it worked. Often, as in the case of his incandescent bulb, he would go through thousands of experiments, discarding each one after it failed until he finally succeeded. This was Edison's example of initial inspiration and then lots of perspiration until the thing worked and he believed he'd gotten it right. Tesla, on the other hand, laid the entire project out in his brain, visualizing it in its completeness, and then assembled it from the vision in his own mind. It was unnerving to Edison, who often commented to his former assistant Charles Batchelor that Tesla's ability to build something from what amounted to a set of schematics in his own mind was unnatural. Tesla was also a fastidious, formally trained academician who loved to discuss theory, while Edison was mostly a self-taught workbench inventor who often worked and slept in the same clothes for days. It is ironic that the rivalry between the two men who, by the time each of them died, had patented inventions upon which most of modern technological industry is built, spawned two great competing companies, General Electric and Westinghouse, whose own rivalries extend to the present day. The rivalry between Edison and Tesla helped define the nature of the electrical power industry in the United States, the electrical appliance and entertainment industries, and sustained itself from the 1890s through the 1930s when Edison finally died. Tesla himself died in New York in 1943. Tesla was an acknowledged genius, a prodigy whose predictions and patents marked him to be a man way ahead of his time. Even before the Czech playwright Karel Čapek coined the word robot in his play RUR, and American science fiction writer Isaac Asimov invented the term robotics in his book of short stories, I, Robot, Nikola Tesla had created the first automaton, or mechanical soldier, and a robotically controlled model boat before the turn of the century. Yet, Tesla, a tall, dark, brooding, but well-educated and cultured Serbian, oftentimes turned out to be his own worst enemy. He became a millionaire when he was only 32, but ran through enormous sums of money put up by some of the great industrialists and financiers of his day, including George Westinghouse, J. Pierpont Morgan, A.